Hello, I'm Amelia Lush, Head of Children's and Young Adult Programs for Sydney Writers Festival. I hope you enjoy this episode of our 2020 All Day YA podcast series. In this conversation, Anna Whateley is joined by Kay Kerr, a fellow neurodivergent author whose debut novel, Please Don't Hug Me, explores love, loss, and friendship through the eyes of Erin, a young woman on the autism spectrum.
Hello and welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival podcast. I'm Anna Whateley, an own voices writer and holder of literature PhD. I've worked with or taught literature for over 20 years in some capacity. And I'm coming to you today from Mianjin, otherwise known as Brisbane, and I acknowledge the country north and south of the Brisbane River as the home of both the Turrbal and Yuggera nations. And my guest is further north on the lands of the Gubbi Gubbi Nation. It's my absolute pleasure to introduce my guest today, Kay Kerr, author of Please Don't Hug Me. Welcome.
Hi, Anna. Thank you for having me.
It is totally my pleasure. And Kay, you are a freelance writer, a former journalist, and now you're also an own voices writer of young adult fiction. But before we talk about your awesome debut novel, I think we should fess up about how we met and how we know each other. And because I emailed you, this is 2 years ago now, before I approached our agent, Danielle Binks, and you got this random email out of the blue.
Yeah, so we both met Danielle, our agent, in the same way through the CYA conference in Brisbane, which is the Children's and Young Adult conference. And I think I had signed with her the previous year and you were about to pitch or had just pitched, is that right?
Yeah, I was about to pitch to her and then I was reading about her other writers that she had on her portfolio and up comes someone writing in own voices, autistic and set a book set in south of Brisbane, and I just thought, oh no, we're too similar, she would never want my book. And so I emailed you to check.
And I got to read a little bit of Peter Lyer's Reading Normal, which was really, even back then, so good, and I was so excited, I think, at the idea that two of these books could exist. I was excited at the idea that one could exist, so two was beyond.
Exactly. And it was such a boost of confidence and to know that I had you supporting me there in approaching her. So thank you. And obviously it all went ahead and now here we are 2 years later doing what people would have thought was never going to happen.
And with our books coming out on the exact same day, it's quite wild.
I know. And the same day as our agent. It's a little bit funny. Oh, dear. Okay, so I'm going to give everyone an introduction to your novel so that then we can talk about it. So Please Don't Hug Me is an own voices young adult novel about Erin, who is looking forward to schoolies, or at least she thinks she is. Things aren't going to plan and everything's getting really messy, and for Erin, as she's autistic, that's a really big problem. She's lost her job at the surf zone after an incident that was clearly not her fault and involving some really gross things. And her driving test goes really badly, even though she follows all the rules, the instructions perfectly. Her boyfriend is not turning out to be the romantic type, and she's missing her brother Rudy, who left almost a year ago. And the novel's set as a series of letters to Rudy. And I was wondering if those letters, as you were writing, were they always to her brother Rudy?
The form when I first started writing the book was very rough and raw. So it was more of a stream of consciousness kind of a style in the very early, I wouldn't call it a first draft, pre-first draft, when I was getting the first words down. And then I think it sort of slowly morphed into, when I was trying to give it some kind of structure and some kind of form, into diary entries, but I quickly realised she was speaking to someone in particular and someone that she knew. So the stuff that was going on with Rudy was already happening on the page, but I sort of redirected Erin, I guess, to be writing to him, because it was somebody that had to know her and know, you know, how she had grown up and enough about her life to be able to be that person close to her that she would want to write letters to.
Yeah, and I think it does take away sometimes the awkwardness of the Dear Diary format of who are you speaking to, so the letters to Rudy feel really natural in that way. And also, Erin does like to use nicknames. And so to help her remember who people are, she gives them a name that then identifies them in some way, like Pointy Kathy or Great White Molly. And I was wondering if it's something you do, and do you have a nickname for me?
So I don't give people nicknames in the same way that Erin does, but I definitely, I guess, in meeting someone, there's a lot to process in a social situation like that. So certain physical attributes might stick in my mind, and I find that in particular I've sort of, even without noticing, trained myself to look at people's mouths when I'm meeting them and talking to them. So if it's something, you know, around their teeth or their mouth or the way they talk or the sound of their voice, that's going to be how I remember that person when I meet them again, and I probably will forget their name. So I often come across as pretty rude like that, but I'm sure if I met you, I would have found you, you know, very open, and your hair color probably would have been something that I would have stuck to mind.
Is red for listeners.
Yes.
Yeah, it is quite red.
Yeah, so that's probably something that would have stuck to mind for me.
Okay, I'll take that. That's all right. Okay, so in the novel, Erin speaks about her fear of having her difference found out, of being discovered. Not her diagnosis so much, but just the difference that that then brings with it. And it's something that a lot of autistic people share. And I was wondering, firstly, I wondered why on earth we then went and wrote books that basically expose all the inner workings of our mind, but also how did writing the novel then change your relationship with your own way of being?
Firstly, I swore to myself, and I suppose I was telling myself a lie at the time, that I would just had to write this book and nobody would ever see it, and I just needed to get it out of my mind. And then I'd put it in a drawer somewhere and never show it to a single person again. So that's how I got past that initial fear of showing people what the inside of my mind looks like. But I think I got my diagnosis sort of quite early on in the writing process, and it wasn't linked to the book at the time. It's just something that happened sort of similarly timed. But it gave me a new perspective, firstly, on myself, and then on my book, and I came back to the story that I thought I was writing, which was about this anxious, awkward girl, and realised that some of the things that she was struggling with were things that I was struggling with in relation to being autistic. So the writing process was a way for me to, I guess, kind of go down a few different paths and explore why I struggled with those certain things, and to gain a better understanding of my own mind through this character whose voice and experiences are really different from mine, but sort of the way she feels and the way she processes things are quite similar.
Yeah, I was going to say sometimes people struggle to see the difference there between what we've written and ourselves as separate,
yeah,
even though we share that voice.
Yeah, and I think I've made peace with that idea that sometimes people are going to mix myself and my character up, because the marketing of my book has very much been around the idea that my diagnosis came through the writing of the book. So initially you kind of think, oh, you know, women are predominantly asked that question, or, you know, is this just your life written through somebody else? But, yeah, I guess I've made peace with the idea that that's part of the story of this book. It's my own story.
It's something that will change in the future with all of your subsequent books that come out.
Yeah.
And I was thinking in that way, did it change when you were looking back after your diagnosis? Did you then change in any way the dynamic in her family, the way that her family works, but also the creation of that whole cast of characters? That I found that quite difficult, to have that many people required to be in my book, which was very much in my head. And I just wondered how you found that.
You've done such a good job of your other characters in your book. Mine were very thin on the page when I started writing. They were sort of mentioned a couple of times and through the context of what Erin was going through, and it was really in the editing process that I had to sort of change my focus from being on Erin to being on these other characters and making sure they had fully formed lives and personalities and feelings and things they were going through. But I think I spend a lot of time with neurotypical people, so I don't necessarily think that I found it hard to write those characters. And because of the way that the book is formed in letters, it's all through Erin's perspective, so it's all through that autistic lens. So even how she's looking at those characters might not be necessarily the way they're processing things, but I think that kind of, you have to be creative in letters as well in the way that you work those things in. They have to be something that you would write to somebody or something that Erin would write to her brother. So yeah, there were definitely some creative choices there.
Yeah, I was going to say, with the letter form and making that a little bit trickier in some ways, did you find any other restrictions using that epistolary format where you can only be writing to her brother as well? So in terms of, it's not a stranger, this is someone she knew deeply.
So in terms of things like place, setting, that kind of thing, there were ways that was woven in, like her doing her driving exam and, you know, learning how to drive gave me a really easy way to talk about the places, you know, the places in Cleveland, which is where the book is set, like the big roundabout or the Cleveland Point or
that roundabout. Sorry, now I'm totally interrupting you. I have to tell you, because in my driving test at that roundabout, I stalled the car. I got up to it and I just stalled it. I didn't fail on that though. You're allowed to stuff up as long as you do the right thing after. Sorry, I didn't like do what happened, and I won't do a spoiler there, but it's hilarious, that bit.
I think everybody has a roundabout story about doing their test, and I failed my test the first time around, I think because I did a minor stuff up, but then I was so in my own head about having made a mistake, I made many, many more mistakes.
And Redlands has the most roundabouts in Australia.
Yeah.
Sorry, now I'm fact dropping. I do apologise, but it does. And I just love that local feeling in the novel that you really get that sense of place, even though it's through letters. And I would have thought I imagine that would be really, really hard, but you make it look seamless the way that you get an idea of the point and where she's living. And
I think, thank you, but I think setting a debut novel in a place that you grew up is a really natural choice because you have such a strong sense of place from, you know, without even necessarily realising that you do because you've absorbed it as a child.
Yeah. And also with the writing of the novel, I think that autistic people often struggle to understand certain figures of speech, especially when we're younger, and we might take things literally. So for me and for other people I know, that actually led to then mastering language in some way or attempting to. And I was wondering if that was true for you, and especially given that you've had writing for your career.
Yeah, I think obviously unconsciously before getting a diagnosis, but I've always put a lot of effort into being understood. And also I was a big reader as a child, so I think I absorbed a lot of language and I was one of those kids that used very sophisticated language from a really young age because I'd read a lot of books, and the books that I was reading were, you know, like Enid Blyton books or Narnia books or The Lord of the Rings or those kinds of ones. So I was sort of running around talking like I was in mid-century England or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think Erin, in that way, in the story as well, is a big reader, and I think that sort of plays into the idea of just trying to figure out how to communicate and to be understood.
Yeah, and she describes a lot of the things that happen with a lot of conceptual metaphors and analogies to other things in her life. But that also, I mean, it seems to be linked to how she's understanding the relationships and events, but it also helps with expanding what would have been restricted by the letter form, do you think?
Yeah, so it wasn't a conscious choice in that I'm going to make Erin speak this way or describe things this way because I'm limited by the letter format. I found the letter format to be really freeing and to give me a real sense of purpose and direction in my writing. So Erin sort of came out that way because she's a reader and because she puts so much importance on fitting in and understanding the people around her. But yeah.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think it definitely still feels like it has such depth. I really love the way that she creates that easy way to understand what's going on for her and how it's feeling for her. The other thing that she points out that really made me think was about that special interests are often a way that we feel grounded and present. And she mentions that people are always criticizing her for not being present in the moment, but then also being too focused on something that she really loves. And I just wondered if you think that being told our special interests aren't normal and that might contribute to the feelings of disassociation that Erin writes about to her brother?
I think probably on a wider level, that the whole idea of trying to be normal, and I'm putting that in inverted commas, but and trying to suppress a natural way of being means that there is a level of, well, for me anyway, personally, I can only speak from my experiences, a level of distance between my experience and other people's experience and my connection to being in the moment. So disassociation was something that I was, I guess, examining through Erin, not even something that I was potentially aware that I was doing in my younger years, but I can look back on, you know, so many of these things, I have the language, you know, since diagnosis, the language and the framework to understand it, things like masking and burnout and executive dysfunction, all these terms that have always been issues for me, but I've just never had the language around it.
Yeah, and now your readers will have that too. So, I mean, and as a young adult novel, it then opens up such a dialogue for people now having those words and making them accessible in different ways, because not everyone's, you know, on Twitter like we are and learning, oh, for me anyway, learning a lot from other platforms. And so having this in the novel, I think that's going to be a great thing. That's not a question, though. That's an observation.
I feel the same way about your book. I feel like I'm learning more about my own way of being autistic through reading Peter Liar, so that's been really exciting.
Thank you. So one of the other things I really liked was her, and I have to do this without any spoilers. This is so hard, though, because I'm just... Yeah, is when Erin's experiencing anger, and I'd say that's one of the least accepted emotions for women to express. But did you find it hard to write, or?
No, I found it really easy to write.
Get the anger out.
I don't know whether it's a getting older thing, whether it's having a child, whether it's getting my diagnosis, but I feel a lot more accepting of my own anger and allowing myself to feel anger instead of pushing it down and putting a smile on my face and playing nice. I think that was a really fun thing to harness with Erin, was anger. I think as a teen, my anger was probably directed at myself through, you know, dislike of my body, dislike of my mind, whatever it was, that was internalized, that anger, instead of allowing it to be shown to the people that probably deserve to have it shown to them. So there's a lot of unlearning that I've done, even separate, or maybe not separate to my autism diagnosis, about the way that women are allowed to process anger.
And it's often displaced, especially in the way it's viewed by the community, with autistic people having tantrums and meltdowns and all the things that you hear about a lot of the time. Rather than thinking where the anger came from and where it probably should have been expressed, and instead there's this focus on, you know, something trivial, which is the moment where it broke out, and it may not actually have been the cause of that. But being inside Erin's head, it's really clear the process and what's going on there.
Because the trigger moment is so far down the path past whatever the thing is that it stemmed from. And I still have vivid memories of having big meltdowns, I guess you would say, as a kid, and all of the shame that comes with bad behaviour and not acting in an acceptable way. So I think writing's been a really good way to process all of that and to remove the shame from it. And I guess, you know, having a child and looking at a child from an adult's perspective and imagining how I would feel as a parent if I was watching that happen. It's totally different.
Yeah. And I was thinking about as well, so in the book, in terms of these other characters we mentioned earlier, Aggie and Dee are both Erin's best friends in different ways, and they're really different to each other as well. So did that throw up any particular challenges to navigate such, and they're in different environments too, so they don't interact between them at all. But did they help in any way with plot in a voice-driven story?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Dee is the school friend and Aggie is the part-time job friend. So giving Erin someone to interact with in both of those spaces was an obvious choice. But also I think with Dee, I wanted to explore that idea of when you've been friends with somebody for a long time and there's a lot of comfort that comes from having somebody know you that well, but there's also times when friendships, and I don't want to give away any spoilers, it's not really spoilers, but when friendships go in different directions or run their course, or you aren't necessarily going to stay best friends forever because you've known each other as children. So I thought that was something that I wanted to explore, especially in relation to how hard change can be being autistic, and how much change is going on at, you know, those last couple of months of high school.
Yeah, and that it's not always hanging on to something. It's not that being autistic makes us want everything to stay the same. It's just that adjustment time being different and sometimes not always realising that the change can be really good for you.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what Aggie brings into the dynamic, is that the idea of her friendship, I think, lets Erin let go a little bit of maybe the friendship that she's holding on to with Dee, the right friendship at the right time. I think one good friend, if you're going through something that's hard, is all you need to help you get through it.
And Aggie's so different and from a different, she at first just comes along. She's such a breath of fresh air for Erin, it feels. Did you have a lot of fun writing Aggie? I have this feeling that she was fun for you to write.
Yes, writing the scenes of Erin and Aggie in the elderly women's clothing shop where they work and what they got up to when there was no customers in the shop were some of my favourite scenes. And there was a few, and then I went back to add a few more when I was doing edits just because they were so fun to write.
That definitely comes across. They're the bits where I was having a good giggle and making my family wonder what on earth I was doing, which is totally fine. So were there any other difficulties you found with creating that structure in the story? Because there's, it's so hard to do without telling anyone what happens. But yeah, plot, when it becomes, because my book's very heady as well, it's very much stuck in your head, and I found plot really difficult. Did you have anything that really helped make sure you had the right sort of structure there? Because it feels very seamless when you're reading, but I know from the writer's perspective that's not always as easy as it looks.
I think breaking it into three parts was really helpful for me for getting the pacing sort of right, because each one felt almost like a little bubble of its own, and I could work up to sort of where that part ended and the next part started. So that I'm someone who likes structure. So having that and the letters as well, I think really helped me hit points along the way. So it wasn't just this big, scary, you know, 50 or 60,000 word thing that I had to put out on the page. And yeah, I need a direction and structure. So that was definitely how I managed that.
Do you think, and I've wondered this myself, do you think that people are going to look beyond the neurodivergence, beyond the autism, and actually see the other themes in Please Don't Hug Me?
I'm not sure. I hope so. I hope, there's a lot that I wrote to around friendship and around family and self-acceptance and finding community that I hope resonates. But at the same time, I think once the book is out there, it's not really in my control anymore. So what people take from it is going to be what they take from it. I don't know. What do you think with your book?
Again, I don't know. I think occasionally I get to other topics in an interview but I think the same. I'm accepting the fact that for a long time it'll be mostly just about our story and the writing of the books and that that's important, and I understand that's important. But yeah, I think sometimes there is a temptation to leave it there as a surface thing. But yeah, I'm hoping, because there is a lot more in both of them, that they're seen for those things as well. But that'll be up to other interviewers, won't it?
Yeah, and it's exciting to think about what the marketing and the talking around a second book might look like once we've kind of discussed ourselves a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And in that vein, because Erin mentions that grief is, and this is what made me think of all this, Erin mentions that grief's exciting to people. So it's kind of magnetic, a bit like when everyone slows down to watch a car crash, or when you want to be on the, people like to be on the news as the best friend of the person who had something happen, and you've got the inside gossip sort of thing. And do you think there's a chance that neurotypical people want to read our autistic and for me ADHD lives to sort of pat us on the head a little bit, to be like, aren't I good I read this book? Or, and do you feel any, have you felt much in terms of being patronised?
Not necessarily in the writing world or the book kind of world. I mean, I've experienced that, look at you out there achieving something sort of in the real world. But I think even if people come to the book in a disingenuous way, I hope that they will come away with some new knowledge or some new understanding or empathy or something like that. That othering in real life, I think, is probably more prevalent than in the book world. But the books give people the diversity tick. I understand that there are people coming to it in that way, and that's something that I've made peace with.
Not much we can do about what people do with it. But it does kind of. It didn't occur to me until later, maybe, that people might see it as another reason to point out the difference, rather than looking for ways to understand or identify. But there we go, we threw that out there. Go us, so brave. And Erin is wondering if her dad is waiting for her to lead the way by accepting herself first, before he can come to terms with her diagnosis. And her parents are really interesting. I find them really interesting characters. So do you think writing in own voice is us taking that front foot of acceptance?
I think when I was first diagnosed personally, I really held on to every wrong comment, that somebody made when I spoke to them about it. If they would say, oh, we're all a little bit like that, or you don't look it, or all those horrible things that you hear, I really held on to every single one of them, and went away and felt the hurt about those things, but didn't say anything in the moment to correct the people. So for me personally, I think I came to a realization, and that particular part of the book was definitely, I think, added in towards the end of my editing process, where I figured if I'm not going to take the lead and I guess correct some of the misinformation or the harmful representation that's out there, then how can I expect people that haven't had a lot to do maybe with autism or with autistic people to seek that information out themselves? So I'm, it's not on every autistic person to do that, I don't think. But if I'm being given a platform and the privilege of people listening to what I say, then I should be taking that front foot. So that's kind of how that perspective for Erin and her dad came in.
Yeah. And her mum, who's very much, I think while she does fit that stereotype of the autism mum, which I might ask you to explain, but I think you also challenge some of that a little bit. You make it a little bit deeper than just that. But would you be able to explain what an autism mum is to people listening? Because again, not everyone thinks about these things.
Yeah. So an autism mum, in the way that we're referring to it, is a mother of an autistic child who has attached themselves in some way to the identity of being an autistic mum. And usually that's in reference to how hard it is to parent an autistic child. So there are lots of groups. And I find, judging from Twitter, it seems to be maybe more in America than in Australia, but there are certainly Maybe not. I'm not sure what you think.
It's growing.
Yeah.
I find it more on Facebook than anywhere.
I think because I'm not on Facebook, I think I saw one too many meltdown videos shared around on Facebook and,
yes,
and I left.
Exactly.
For my mental
and
health.
And the humour of the autism mum hashtags and because autism was the hashtag. So this thing happened in my life because autism.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay.
And I think it's treated really as like everything bad that happens is because of autism, as if every other child is waltzing through their life acting 100% perfectly all the time and never having tantrums or meltdowns or coming up against any struggles or challenges. So,
And there's no sense of privacy for the autistic child, that what they're experiencing is there for either, you know, for ridicule or to be viewed by everybody as it's put online.
Yeah, it's very dehumanising in the way that it is put out there, not for sympathy of for the child, but for sympathy of the parent having to manage that behaviour. I find that to, like, the to be hard to deal with. But with Erin's mum, who you were asking about, I wrote her. I found her to be quite a supportive mother, but I think, you know, that those views of autistic mums don't sort of appear or in a vacuum, like they don't just pop up out of nowhere. I think people are maybe disengaged or feeling like they don't have a lot of support around them and seeking out support groups and then almost being sort of radicalized in a way through those groups of what is acceptable and what is accepted, and therefore then sort of steering themselves more in that way. So I can imagine that Erin's mum Googling, sort of looking for support, and maybe she came across some diets that she found might help, you know.
Yeah, and you get asked. You get asked by doctors, have you tried these things? It's very easy to go down those. But there's a sense of compassion from Erin for that in the novel, you know.
Well, I think, like, empathy, like huge debilitating empathy is something that I've struggled with for my whole life. I'm not sure. You're nodding along, so I feel
I am
like
nodding.
We're
sorry,
on the,
no one can see me nodding.
I feel like we're on
fidget.
The same. I feel like we're on the same page. So, as much as Erin is feeling all of the ways in which people are not accepting her and how hard that is for her, she's also feeling empathy for the people that are treating her that way, because she's feeling like she's not easy to be around, or she's not giving them what they need in their relationship.
Yeah, it's such a huge focus of her struggles is trying to come to terms with other people's needs. But there's no, it's not a selfish thing. And I think for people, for me, there was just a lot of recognition and understanding of what she was talking about. But I guess for other people that might be a new thought, because there's this dialogue out there that autistic people don't feel empathy, which is just such a ridiculous notion when it is, as you say, just this completely overpowering.
I think we just, autistic people maybe just don't show it in a neurotypical way. So that's a very sort of thin, narrow sort of view of what empathy looks like, and it's not fitting within that space. So,
Hopefully we'll change the dialogue. We're doing it. And in that way as well, there were some moments in Please Don't Hug Me that meant a lot to me personally, like how she finds exams relaxing because she can focus more easily and, you know, everyone's quiet and they have to sort of do what they're doing and you don't have as many things to judge at the same time as trying to do your work. And even down to the point, and I sent you this when I read it, where her mum's sort of patting her on the arm to be comforting, but Erin notices it's actually just kind of annoying because she can't reach the salad bowl anymore. And I found that, I mean, that just for me was a brilliant moment, because they're the little things that just helped with that sense of identification and knowing that I don't have to be necessarily ashamed of those thoughts. They're something that other people think, and it's a very practical thing. But it doesn't mean that she didn't care and appreciate her mum's attempt to soothe her in some way. So they help me feel part of a community, and so I fully expect other readers will feel that as well. Have you had other comments along those lines from readers?
Yeah, so I think I've only had a little bit of feedback. I've been getting some nice emails and messages on social media and that kind of thing, but there definitely is a difference between the autistic people that have been in contact with me and the neurotypical people that have been in contact with me. I think, like you said, maybe people on the spectrum are finding small moments and they're highlighting that. And that's what when I've read Autistic Rep, it's been those small things that have made me feel like it's the first time I've read those in a book, and I've been reading for, you know, 25, 30 years, however long. So seeing those things on the page is really important and really affecting. Mm. And then maybe with neurotypical people, the feedback has been sort of wider around themes like not fitting in, like, oh, I really related to, you know, Erin's experiences and not feeling like she fits in, or, you know, friendships and friendships, how they sort of run their course. That's been, yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's the other thing they've... So there've only been a few own voices novels in the past, you know, set in Australia. I don't know, Brisbane, that might be pushing it a little bit far, with autistic protagonists. And we're publishing at the same time and taking over the publishing world, and I think we're doing a very good job of that. Has it occurred to you that we are the ones making the tropes?
That's a big thought.
Yeah, I like big thoughts.
I hope we do take over the world a little bit. That would be nice. In some ways it feels like a little bit of pressure. If I look at it in a certain way, I think I can't be all things to all people, because this is one character that I've written, one experience I've lived. So it's never going to cover all bases. You know, the old adage of if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. So, but on the other hand, I think, like I said before, if I'm getting this platform and I'm getting the privilege of having my book published, I can bring autism and autistic characters into spaces and rooms and conversations that it might not necessarily have otherwise been. So it's really exciting when I think of it that way. That's how I have to frame it.
I know. And I really want to talk about some of what I think would become tropes in some ways, but it would probably tell too much of the novel. But there are some similarities between ours, and that will just, yeah, I guess one day we do get to talk about them in that way.
It's funny because when I only received your book, I think, yesterday, so yeah. I've been sort of power reading it. But when I'd been talking about our books previously, I'd been saying, you know, it's amazing that these two books exist and they're so different and they've both come out at the same time, and they are so different. But as I'm reading it, there's just themes and things in there that I go, oh, that is so familiar, even though the stories and what the characters are going through is so different.
Yeah, and like, how did that happen that we've both come up with those? Yeah, I think that's excellent. But it was just such a great moment to read them, and done so differently. So I'm looking forward to our autism tropes or whatever again, but not stereotypes. Like, this is very different. I don't want people to hear what I'm saying and think it's going to be, I'm talking about the stereotypical representations of autism we see in media already. This is different things, and they'll have to read it to find out what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and the idea of there being enough autistic books that there are tropes is exciting.
Exactly, and then having, more than one, and we need... If you think how many representations of yourself you see as a middle-class white boy reading growing up, the amount of representations you see of middle-class white men, well, you have a lot to choose from there. And we didn't get that many, and we need more. So for us, that's going to be great when that happens. And do you think adults will find their way to your novel, or do you think there's still prejudice around the young adult fiction being light?
I think I've probably been a little bit oblivious to those sort of preconceptions, because I've always read YA and I've always loved YA, and I've always, that coming of age kind of figuring out who you are and what you want to do with your life, that's like, they're my favourite books to read still now. So I can't... Same. Yeah, I can't imagine when I wouldn't be seeking those stories out. So I know that there's lots of other adults that read YA, and maybe there might be adults that come to our books in particular because they know young people or young autistic people. So that's exciting. That's
yeah. And I just think that's that's a gift that we're giving, basically, for them to be able to understand their children better, and then maybe, you never know, themselves as well, to understand themselves reading the novels. It might help. And I've heard people commenting about both our novels that they're understanding their own teenage years through a different lens, and perhaps thinking maybe they weren't so alone as they felt at the time.
Yeah, and I think especially Australian YA is really progressive in terms of things that it tackles in comparison to other literature. So I'm always excited to see what's happening in Love Oz YA.
Yeah, we rock. So I think we can all agree that Please Don't Hug Me is a really important novel and one that everyone needs to order from their local bookshop, although some are open now so they can actually go in and find their own. And thank you, Kay Kerr, for joining me to talk about Please Don't Hug Me for the Sydney Writers Festival. And I know we're not in person and down on stage, but I think this is still pretty special. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.